Hi, everyone, and welcome to today's event, Bridging Traditions and Technology, Access to Healthcare Innovation in Indigenous Communities. We're delighted to host this event to hear from healthcare leaders from Indigenous communities who will discuss strategies to improve access to healthcare innovations and care. My name is Olivia Phillips, and I'm the Manager of Equity Initiatives at Matter. For those of you who aren't familiar and you're joining us today for the first time, welcome. For those of you who are familiar with Matter, again, welcome. And here's just a little bit of an overview. Matter is a healthcare technology incubator and innovation hub with a mission to accelerate the pace of change of healthcare. And in service of this mission, we do three things. First, we incubate startups. Since our inception, we have worked with over 800 companies that range from very early to growth stage startups. And we have a suite of services to help them at every stage of development. Second, we work with large organizations such as healthcare systems, life sciences companies, payers, universities, and those alike to strengthen their innovation capacity. During this, we help them find value in emerging technology solutions, empower internal innovators to unlock the value of their ideas, and create a more human-centered healthcare experience through system-level collaboration. And third, we are a nexus for people who are passionate about healthcare innovation. We bring people together to be inspired, to learn, and connect with each other. And we produce a lot of programs such as this one, including large-scale events for the broader community and other forums exclusively for our members and also our broader audience. With that, we'd like to dive into the topic of today's event. So according to the American Indian Policy Institute, 18% of reservation residents lack internet access, 33% rely on cell phone service only, 49% utilize land-based internet providers, and 31% have spotty internet connection. The limited access to services presents major barriers to access to innovative healthcare solutions to improve healthcare disparities such as diabetes, chronic liver diseases, and more. Today, we're joined by Rafael Tapia, Director of Tribal Community Connections at Local First Arizona, for a discussion moderated by John Achukian, Healthcare Management Consultant with CWH Advisors, to discuss the role of the digital divide in Native American and Indigenous communities, how to increase access to innovative solutions to improve health outcomes, and share strategies for innovators who are developing solutions to support Native American and Indigenous communities while respecting and preserving their rich cultural heritage. A few housekeeping things. If you have any questions for our speakers throughout the program, please put them into the chat. And also, everyone is muted. So again, any questions or comments, please drop there. Without further ado, I will pass it over to John.
Thank you, Olivia. Hi, everyone, and thank you for joining today. My name is John Achukian, and I will be your moderator. I'm a healthcare management consultant with CWH Advisors out of Boston, and I serve as a mentor in residence at the University of Arizona Forge, finding opportunities and resources to grow entrepreneurs Forge. I'm here along with our guest, Rafael Tapia Jr., who is one of my colleagues. We both serve as mentors, and Rafael heads up Native Forge. As a reminder, this session will be recorded. Please put any of your questions in the chat, and we will be happy to answer and discuss them. At the end, we'll leave time to open it up for a general discussion, and we want to make this as interactive as possible. Just a little bit about Rafael. So Rafael is a member of the Paspa Yaqui tribe and the Director of Tribal Community Connections at Local First Arizona, serving Arizona's 22 federally recognized tribes and nations. Local First Arizona, also known as LFA, is a 20-year-old nonprofit focused on building vibrant, inclusive, and prosperous economies in rural and tribal communities. LFA services include business, workforce, community, and infrastructure development resources and advocacy. Rafael's experience includes being the vice president of a national Native nonprofit serving hundreds of tribal communities and director of outpatient treatment centers focusing on alcohol addiction, behavioral health, social, and residential treatment services. Rafael has an MBA from the University of Arizona and an economic development certificate from the University of Oklahoma. Thank you, Rafael, for being with us today.
Thank you, John. Appreciate that intro.
Absolutely. I'm going to kick it off, Rafael, by First of all, thank you for discussing this important topic. And just to set the stage, can you describe the traditional cultural, medicinal, diet, and food practices of Native American tribes prior to European contact and how they contributed to health and well-being and some of the situations and outcomes that we're seeing today?
First, Don, if I may introduce myself formally in my language. Liosem Taniabo, Kechemalia, Aisemeane, Cabecoque, Cabecoque. Inipo Rafael Tapia Tiak, Inta Tequipanoa, Director of Tribal Community Connections, Local First Arizona. Obviously, that last part, John, was not in my language, but it's a formal greeting. And when we're talking about health and wellness, that's our way of connecting. That's our way of looking at how we're related to everything that is human and our other relatives that exist on this land. So with that, the topic of technology and traditions, you know, I was looking at, you know, how do I approach this subject? Because some of the information I'm going to share, John, is pretty extensive in terms of when you look at that there are masters and PhD in what is called Indian studies. Many universities have those programs. So I'm going to only carve out a piece of what somebody would go and get their PhD in this topic of what's going on in Indian country or what's gone on and the impacts today. I looked up the word technology, and it's the application of conceptual knowledge for achieving practical goals, especially in a reproductive way. And so based on that definition, and looking at what's going on today, we have to roll back a little bit here. Not too long ago when, you know, tribes existed here and first contact was not 1492. Most folks think 1492 was first contact between tribes and Europeans. There's evidence of prior contact before then. And so it's recorded in our stories. It's recorded in some of the writing that existed in this land. So we have two different parts of the U.S. history. 1492, the Eastern connection where Columbus landed. 1519 is the other one. I'm sitting here in Arizona. 1519 is a more relevant story. Hernan Cortes landed in what is now Mexico City. We had the impact of the 1519 story, but we hear more in public education, the 1492, and then the expansion west of the Mississippi. But before contact, first contact, Native people, indigenous people lived in their environments, lived in harmony with their environments. It was a reciprocal relationship, a social relational model. It was not an extractive or a transactional only model where I'm taking but not giving back. The idea that we could own a mountain, we could own land was non-existent because those things were sacred. So contact changed a lot of how we looked at the world around us. As hard as we tried to maintain our way of life, the impact has been significant. Our food systems were disrupted. And, you know, initially at first contact, the idea was to look at from the exploration. Then it became the plan to eliminate or exterminate Native people. And so those were harsh times that have impacted generations. And you're seeing some of those impacts today where we're still trying to maintain and restore our ancestral ways. Tribes were not designated to a land base. Now we have 574 tribes that are federally recognized nations in the United States. So we have 574. before contact, there were thousands of nations here thriving with their own economic and trade routes and food systems. And those were completely disrupted. The food sources of Native people were part of the colonization and conquest, and controlling Native people. Eliminate the food source, weaken the people, and so it's easier to control them. And, you know, we faced consistent impacts of resources being taken. Things we didn't understand, again, land ownership, property rights, those things were foreign concepts. Owning something sacred was outside of what we understood. And so for us, we live within a larger ecosystem. Food and the food system is a part of that. We are not alone. And so unless we take care of those resources, we're not going to survive. And that was the thought in most indigenous ways, that our food systems aren't just feeding us, they're feeding generations yet unborn. That's a different way of looking at food system and health and wellness and our connection to everything that is. So impact of colonization really disrupted those cultural ways, those ancestral ways, those practices that were inherent in indigenous communities. They had adapted to their environments, their ecosystems, in ways that I think now we're learning about in today's society, that we need to bring those systems back, not only for the well-being of our culture and our indigenous ancestral practices, because they're important to us, but that these are some of the solutions that are going to help us deal with some of the impacts we're dealing with in today's environment. We're not in reservations. And so there's just over 300 reservations in the country. And in each of these communities, most of them, the reservations were not established for the well-being of indigenous people. They were first established as prison camps. Most of them had a fort next to them. And so the idea was, isolate them or imprison them. And part of the agreement was, because the rest of their land was taken in exchange, the federal government would provide food to Native people. And so commodities, we know the commodities program. Native people did not understand what processed food was. It was not part of our indigenous diet to eat processed food. And so when those changes happened and the impact of colonization impacted our food sources and our way of life, growing our food, hunting for our food, or gathering our food were replaced with processed food, things that already came packaged and processed. And so one of the things that most people think are ancestral foods is fry bread. Fry bread is a oppression food. Fry bread is a survival food because we didn't know what else to do with flour, lard, and sugar. And so in order to survive, fry bread was something that came out of that time period. People got sick. One of the biggest things that we're seeing in our community today is that these diets that we were introduced to, we're dealing with some of the highest rates of diabetes. Some of these health disparities are off the charts in Indian country, and it has to do with that impact that happened hundreds of years ago and that are still impacting us today.
Thanks, Rafael. How would you say, can you draw us, I know you gave a great example with the fry bread. Can you give us other examples of the traditional diet and what the impacts have been to processed food or the undermining of food sources, traditional food sources, and some of those conditions that we're seeing with tribes?
So before contact, we either gathered our food and we were good stewards of the land, because we knew that if we over harvested that food, we could lose it. And so we had ways to move to different food sources, depending on the climate, depending on the season. We knew enough of that knowledge to live in that way in harmony with our environment. Some societies had a root in agriculture, so they grew their foods. Three Sisters is a very popular native food. Squash, corn, and beans. So most of what was being grown here in the Americas, today I believe the number is 60% of foods that were originally here in the Americas are now what feeds the rest of the world. 60% of our world foods came from the Americas. And beans, corn, and squash are at the heart of it. So you have ancestral foods that were here. The Three Sisters is a big one. It's very well known. And so along with that, you might have heard about the history of in the Northern Plains and the buffalo and how important it was, not only as a food source, but also as part of the ceremony and culture of the Northern Plains people. And the bison, the buffalo, almost was hunted down and killed intentionally to extinction. I mean, there's pictures of these mountains of skulls, and those were buffalo skulls, because the government paid people to get out there and kill the buffalo. Sometimes they were riding trains and knew where the herds were, so they hired these folks to get on the trains, and that was part of how they fought the Indian Wars. Undermine their food resources, weaken them so that it's easier to subjugate them. And so food was connected to a policy of extermination and assimilation. And so for us, those sources are critical today in order for us to restore not only our ways that kept us healthy for thousands and thousands of years, but are also going to be part of our future. When we look at, as I mentioned earlier, technology, how can you replicate something in a goal? Our goal is not just for our survival, but a survival of generations to come. And so we learn to live within these systems in that way. And so that knowledge is still fortunately intact for many of our tribal communities, very intact, that technology, that know-how. And so these ways are what is at the forefront of restoring our well-being and addressing some of the issues that you're seeing in Indian country, where those food resources impacted our health and well-being. Now, John, most folks look at food as a physical experience. We don't look at it in that way. Food is holistic. It's a spiritual, mental, physical and emotional relationship, something that gives you life. There's nothing more sacred than that. But a lot of times we've disconnected from that because we go and buy it. And what's sacred about getting a package of chicken drumsticks from the and serving it? Well, in our communities, there's still that relationship where food is a spiritual part of our well-being, and we look at it as a holistic experience. Physical, spiritual, mental, and emotional. Some of our foods that we use to season our food, we use in ceremony. And so that is something that in contemporary society, for example, when you look at Western medicine, quite a bit of it, and I think it's changing, is symptomatic. We treat the symptom, not the root cause. And so our way of looking at food and the role it plays in well-being is that if you're feeding your body, your spirit, your mind, your emotions, not only the good things that come in life, but also the food, it leads for a healthier person, healthier individual. That's going to be a stronger member of that community.
And that's a good segue to where we're going to go next. Can you share with us any policies or government actions that have helped or possibly undermined nutritional, behavioral, physical health with the nations?
So in Arizona, currently on the table are access is the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System, I think it's what it's called. Access here is Medicaid, Medicare. And so for many tribal communities, access is the bread and butter for medical and behavioral health care, also long-term care. All of that is rolled in under that. Historically, traditional medicine has not been a factor in how the Western model of medicine, healthcare, has engaged and served tribes. There's an opportunity on the table right now where Access is going to incorporate into its healthcare practices the ability for traditional medicine to be included in there. People were not dealing with pre-contact. We weren't dealing with this, epidemic, this food epidemic in our communities that has cost us lives. Our morbidity rates for infants and adults are much shorter than other Americans. I mean, I'm in my community at one point, men weren't living past 38 years old. Think about it. I mean, no grandpas, we had grandmas. And some of it was health related. Some of it were related to the impacts of societal economic issues. But, the morbidity rates regarding health, how we don't live as long, when that was never the case. That was never the case in our communities. And so, some of this in terms of policy is now, there's a bit of a shift. The other is incorporating more healthcare professionals that are from the community, that understand the community. Most of us didn't know probably, and maybe some folks do on here, that reservations weren't meant for the well-being of the tribes. They were prison camps and were meant to eliminate or exterminate the native people. Just things like that, that, we some people think, the Indians moved into the reservation. No, we didn't move. We were forced into reservations. And so, those disconnects of what actually happened and what we learned, I think are very critical. And so when you have folks in the system that don't know the community you're serving, just that there is a lot of trauma still there that happened not too long ago. Not only were the plan to eliminate or exterminate, the assimilation plan included taking our kids at 4 years old and sending them to boarding school to be converted, not allowed to learn their language, their ancestral ways. Some of those children did not come back. They died at boarding schools. They were traumatized. And those that did come back, now we have generations of families whose ancestor or elder went to boarding school and was completely traumatized. So those intergenerational impacts have everything to do with our healthcare. And so it's called trauma-informed practices now that the system is incorporating into their way of dealing with not only indigenous people, but people that have been traumatized historically here in the United States. I think those practices need to continue as an acknowledgement of what is going on in our communities or what has happened in our communities, and that those that history that most of us sometimes don't know about because we're not educated in the real history in public school, that it factors into the well-being of Native people today. So some of those changes that are happening to incorporate best practices around what happened to the indigenous people, who needs to serve best those indigenous people and bring those into this model, merging traditional practices with contemporary Western medical model practices, allowing somebody who will, maybe thrive from seeing a traditional medicine person versus just a doctor. I think those are some of the things that are important. Also acknowledging that, you know, medical care hasn't always been good quality care for tribal people. And so there's some efforts to, and there are efforts to make sure that we also have good quality care in our system. We just don't have doctors that are not wanted in other systems, and they end up in our system because we'll take anybody. So I think the some of those screening and vetting practices are also important, because I'll tell you, we haven't gotten the best of the best when it's come to healthcare.
Thanks, Rafael. We have a question from our audience, from our group. So in reference to nutrition-related disease states, you provided some great examples. Do you have examples of how registered dietitians are currently used in your health systems? And can you describe how they can gain access or how they can interact with tribal members?
I think the many of the tribes are, you mentioned practices earlier. So many of the tribes have started to what is called compacting. They're taking over the control of their services. And what they're doing is looking at how to merge contemporary knowledge and technology with ancestral ways. And so oftentimes, you know, what happens in our communities is folks come in and it's like, oh, well, we know best because I got a degree or I'm a doctor. And ignore that there's knowledge there, that there are other forms of treatments and practices that need to be considered. And so when we go into a community, I think it's important to understand that there is already something there. We're not going in just to fill a void. And how do we one, it might just be understand that something's there. Two is, how do I then merge what I'm doing with what's already there? Oftentimes, a doctor has never been exposed to a traditional medicine or a registered dietitian. They probably never sat across a traditional medicine person that knows botany, that knows the herbs, that could heal somebody locally, because those are part of the important part of the healing or wellness process. Exactly what that dietitian is trying to accomplish when they're going in and trying to impact something, somebody's health and well-being. So I think it's how we go about the approach, the mindset that matters. We deal as people being in our communities, there's a lot of distrust because of what's happened in medical practice. You know, either our knowledge has been stolen and now you see it commoditized, and some of the some of the pharmaceutical companies own what we know. We're not making any money off of it. Or in some cases, our blood has been taken because we're a homogenous group and they want to study what that means. And it's impacting maybe potential outcomes for, diabetes treatment without the consent of the people. So the medical profession, there's still a distrust in some of our communities. So we have to understand there's that relationship we need to address, in that I can be trusted. I'm talking fundamentals here. Unless we can get to the relationship and hurdle that obstacle of the distrust of the history, the trauma that's there, we're never going to get to what we can actually do and help one another with. So I think it's really important to look at that even before contact. How am I approaching the community? How am I understanding the community? What do I know about this community? And each one, I mentioned there's 574 reservations. They're all unique. Some of them have their own language. They're not all one language. A lot of times Native people get lumped into, oh, Native Americans. You know, we're both an ethnic and a political group. So we have a very unique situation here in the United States. And so our interactions can be very complex. You know, not all of us have clan systems. Some of us have kinship systems. And so I would say, know the community that you're going into, try to get as much information, because then that helps you to build that relationship to then apply what you're trying to do as a registered nurse or a doctor in serving that person that you're working with.
Thanks, Rafael. During A recent conversation, I know you were there as well, we had with some tribal members. We learned that there have been some more local tribal health initiatives that have incorporated traditional medicine. And it has really led to some increased engagement, adoption of health services, improved outcomes, actually some enthusiasm around healthcare. Can you share some of the examples with the tribes that have implemented these initiatives and share with us, like, I know you've already been sharing a lot of it, but what it's taking to change the perceptions and view towards healthcare? Because I thought actually that was one of the more positive conversations we've had recently. Maybe you can elaborate on that.
Absolutely. It's exciting to see those advances that tribal communities have had to initiate, even though it's sometimes obvious, there's practices here that could potentially impact people's health and well-being and have a tremendous impact in their lives. But it hasn't always been incorporated into how funding or resources or programs have been established. Tribes have had to advocate, lobby, tirelessly, fight for that right to have those types of services integrated. Some tribal communities have created alternative medicine programs where they have chiropractic work, where they have acupuncture, where they have a naturopathic doctor with a traditional medicine person treating a patient. And then you have the Western service model services where they go see an MD or a specialist. And so it's exciting to see the integration of those and the impact it's having, because when somebody goes and sees, we're taught from the beginning about our role as an individual in the much larger scheme of things, our family, our community, our world. And so when you go to a place and you don't see yourself, it's like, well, how can I access this and connect with this if I don't even see myself? So when tribes are engaging their own practices, engaging their own medicine people, opening up options for their citizens to be well, and they have a choice, where before there wasn't a choice, it was this way, or in some cases, IHS and other medical facilities can maybe, there's some data on this. Most of us will wait till we're in serious health conditions until we'll go to the doctor. Unless we're dying, we're not going to see a doctor. So that preventative medicine that could be there, I think now with the changes that are going on, we have more opportunity in this integrated model to focus more on the preventative versus waiting till somebody's in a crisis. And it's been because of those changes that are going on in the healthcare systems that the tribe have been putting together. Some, again, have created their own services side by side. IHS is the funding that's received from the federal government to provide healthcare. And I believe IHS has been also doing work to really reinvent themselves to look at incorporating these practices or even referring people to folks or organizations that provide those resources that they might not be able to provide, given that, some of these traditional medicine practices, it's not like you can go to school and then do it. It's inherent something that is, they learn through the ancestral and the tribal practices. There's no school for it. So finding those resources is also a critical point in what's going on here, because they're identifying these individuals and bringing them into the healthcare process.
Excellent. And that's a positive. What do you think changed, Rafael, to get IHS, on board with more of the traditional medicine, or do you think it was inevitable?
I think there's a number of things that have happened. I spoke about the impact of colonization on our food system, but it also impacted our what is education, what is mastering a profession, what is, you know, so everything kind of just changed in a way that it was foreign to us. So, you know, now as we've come to terms of, you know, we've got to take control and heal ourselves, because absent that, it's not going to happen. And you know, tribes have been making headway in how it's doing that to take back control. You know, in some respect, living on a reservation land, you're still considered a ward of the federal government. You know, reservations, the land is still owned by the federal government. It just happens that tribe happened to be in there. They can show that they live there. And so, okay, this is who's going to live there. But it's still owned by the federal government. So control over your current situation and your future are things that are going on. And education is one of the things that we've been seeing in tribal communities that has taken a foothold and impacting these other areas of healthcare, of law, of policy, of practice. Because now we have folks that are educated in these systems that have their degrees. And so we've learned to live what you call two worlds. We have our world, and then we have the world outside that looks at things differently than we do at times. We have some shared views, perspectives, obviously, but then there's other things that are very different in our orientation to how we look at the things that we experience in life. And so education took a while, because education in the beginning was harmful and a threat to our existence, boarding schools. And then now, you know, we have a generation that are going and getting their degrees, and healthcare is one of education is the other, legal, business. And so that knowledge that we now have about how these systems work, because we're very fluent in that system at these levels, we're able to advocate and articulate how some of these things need to change and the future that we can be a part of. We need to be part of the future in how these practices and how policy is shaped, and how at the end of it all, when it gets delivered to the citizen, how that's transmitted at that level.
Thanks, Rafael. We have another question. So I think where this question is going is kind of a geographical look at things. And which indigenous groups or organizations you would recommend someone to pursue an innovation and partner with? And how would they find or be introduced to such groups? I know you mentioned, I think, 574 tribes. So their actual specific question was, is there information about this at the county level? So I don't know how the breakdown is based on the tribes, but is there some sort of view? And do you have an opinion on nations that might be maybe more open or looking for innovation partners?
There's the National Indian Healthcare Association. I think that's what they're called. They're a very innovative group. Also, I believe if you are looking at policy level, and then who's connected, because you usually have stakeholders that are in this space of innovation and practice, is under the National Congress of American Indians, NCAI.org, I believe. They have their footprint in almost everything. Again, they're pretty much considered the lobbying arm for all the nations that are members in the United States, whether they're federally recognized tribes, which is the 300 plus reservations. There's 574 federally recognized tribes, and then there's over 300 state recognized tribes. And each one, there's a very different designation when you look at the makeup of that recognition. And then you have over 300 plus bands and other configurations. So there's these organizations that serve as organizing entities for these initiatives, including healthcare innovation. So those would be a couple. I have a couple other ones. I can't remember their names, but if there's a way I can transmit that information as a follow-up, I can provide that. You also have at the local level within tribes, now they're operating health departments. And so they have a full-fledged systems where they provide sometimes limited healthcare initiatives or mental health services. And so they're always looking to partner and collaborate. They're under the tribal government. So most of these programs are subunits of tribal governments because they're considered, each tribal government is considered a sovereign nation.
Great. And I know that the title of this topic was the digital divide. Can you just paint us a picture of the typical tribe interaction and technology, whether it's reaching, not reaching, what a realistic expectation is for telehealth on the tribe? I this is something I think that most of us would love to learn.
Yeah, I think the adage of location factors into this as well. Arizona has 22 tribes, for example. And so we have Salt River, Pima, Indian Maricopa Reservation. We have Gila River Indian Community. Those communities might be more connected, but you still have pockets within those communities where you can't have access or the bandwidth is just not there. Then you go up to the Four Corners area of Arizona, and you have deserts there where access to connectivity is just non-existent. The likelihood of a cell phone, yes, but anything other than a cell phone might be a stretch in some of our communities. And there's a number of factors. One is the infrastructure that hasn't been built out in those communities. So obviously it impacts connectivity and access. The other is the cost of connecting. We have communities where they're condensed. And like, for example, my tribe, we're condensed into 2,200 acres. Navajo Nation, it's larger than a couple of states combined. And so citizens live in places where they might be 5 miles away from each other. And there's mountains and other challenges that impact the infrastructure from being built out. So there's some work being done, obviously under some of the initiatives that have come out from the federal government to connect rural and tribal communities. And so there's still a ways to go. You heard the numbers from earlier that were shared about how many citizens lack connectivity or even a cell phone. Part of that might be where communities are prioritizing their investments. Is it cell phone or is it healthier food or connectivity? And so, some of the socioeconomic challenges impact this question of connectivity and where governments, tribal governments, are investing their resources.
And I know we weren't set up to do a poll, but I'm really curious about the audience that we have. Can everybody just in the chat put in where they are? Northeast, Southeast, Midwest, West, Northwest, or Southwest? Just curious. Really curious about this. Just type it in the chat. Love to get a picture of where everybody is. I mean, Rafael, you probably are in communication with multiple nations. I know I've only interfaced with Tulsa, New Mexico, and Arizona. So, three states. But I think you tell us, Raphael, is there still a lot of geographical disparity amongst the tribes and where they're located with regards to technology, say, you know, I don't know, Oklahoma versus Arizona versus maybe someplace else?
Yeah, I think there is, you know, in some places, you know, tribal communities that are more isolated have more bigger challenges with and larger land base impact, you know, the technology access and the infrastructure. It's a cost issue. And then sometimes there could be implications of, for example, some communities, it's against the cultural ways to start putting up cell towers on sacred places where they could have access to technology or connectivity. And so some of these challenges impact development as well that are steeped in culture and the ancestry. So, you know, is putting a tower to connect as an option to digging lines and putting them in. So those are some of the implications, some of the tribal technology concerns. Those are implications there. And so there is a difference in how a community interacts with adopting or developing technology into the community.
So last question before we open it up for questions. What innovation opportunities do you see out there? Like those young organizations or maybe mature organizations that want to do the right thing, want to go about it the right way, you know, are learning about the cultural sensitivities, are learning about the history, you know, is there a way, is there an on-ramp for them to help and bring those innovations to the tribes and nations?
Yeah, I think, you know, again, there are these movements in Indian country to bring these technologies that are going to impact health and well-being for the citizens. I just saw one of the individuals, Tyler, on here list the organization he's with and the tribes, the healthcare systems he's working with, Cherokee, Choctaw. You know, those nations are definitely making progress in the things that are going on in the healthcare and technology space. I mean, they're running their own hospitals in some respect and have their own healthcare systems intact and building on them. So there's existing organizations that are, I think, there's an opportunity to partner with them. In some cases, you know, having somebody within the tribal that's made headway, inroads into, you know, the tribal community, it's getting with those folks. Sometimes you need that, what is called street cred, right? Because sometimes coming in cold, sometimes it can be challenging navigating our tribal systems. And so, you know, having somebody that's already done some of the work or an organization that is in this pathway of innovation and is looking to partner because they're out there, I think, you know, that's something to look for. Again, I'm referencing one of the participants that's in here, but there's a number of organizations like that that are looking to either create it as a direct support to citizens and they want to adopt it as part of their healthcare practices, or tribes are making investment and looking to diversify their portfolio in terms of what they're doing to bring economic wellness to their community. And so there's investment groups that are focused, tribal groups that are focused that on looking for those opportunities. Again, it's getting somebody that knows the tribal landscape and partnering with them. And, you know, that'd be one recommendation.
So So Raphael, on that note, we just got a flurry of questions. Jack, to you, I think Olivia, we can get you our LinkedIn addresses and our email addresses, so we can get those to you. Chris, you have a question for Raphael. Have you seen tangible examples where sustainable practice, much needed for climate, et cetera, export has been accepted from indigenous origins into the broader American population? So I think what we're talking about here is innovations from the tribes that have gone to the broader American population. Great question.
I don't know that the advances have been as significant as they could be, and so I think, you know, there's now acknowledgement. It takes us a while to acknowledge that you know, something could be good for the overall well-being, especially when you have a history of what's gone on between tribal nations and here in the Americas. You know, the ingenuity, the knowledge and know-how hasn't been readily acceptable. I mentioned this, for example, when some of the what we'll call settlers were coming into parts of this part into the Northwest, the tribes were you know, they observed the tribes burning the land, and they thought they were crazy for burning the land. They didn't realize it was part of the keeping the ecosystem healthy. Now we call it control burns, and it's part of our national system and how we take care of our forests and our natural resources. So it's things like that that I think, you know, we come into a moment where, yeah, these things could help. You know, there's an indigenous ingenuity that could make a difference. I don't know that it's quite there yet. And there's two parts to this. One, because of that history. The other is because sometimes tribes feel like, you know, there's always this extractive relationship where it's taken from them and then somebody else ends up doing something with it and they never ask for permission. So I think there's a relationship, the bridging that needs to happen in that respect. And so, you know, I think there's some seeds that have been planted and I think, you know, we'll start seeing hopefully some changes in that space where this knowledge and know-how is more fully incorporated into our practices. I mean, food systems, we're dealing with a commoditized system. You know, the commoditized system now is taken over by big corporate. We have small farmers and growers or specialty crop where it's not commoditized. They're going away. They're going away. And so we have some challenges here. And so how do you commoditize indigenous ingenuity when you have the bottom line that is the priority, not the health and wellness of the food that is being produced and sold and consumed?
There's one last question, maybe we could fit it in. There's a question is, do you feel that innovations like you were talking about in the tribal community can also be cross-cultured to other communities, i.e. the migrant communities and migrant communities that are coming in?
I think our folks had extensive networks. Indigenous people had an extensive trade and in that trade and economic network, we also had knowledge we shared about practices. So I know that for Indigenous people, there was always that in place. We learned from one another. We contributed to, you know, the well-being. And I believe that that is possible because at the end of the day, if something's good for people and it's done in a way where they understand it's good for them, I really think that people are going to go for the impact that it's going to have in their lives versus where it came from. And I think, you know, that's how we approach it, I think, makes a difference when we put that into practice. And so the goal is to get people healthier and to be well. So I really think that is a possibility. One is making sure whoever owns that technology or that know-how, that knowledge, that there's a respect given, that permission is asked, because a lot of the distrust comes from things just being taken, and then it never benefits that community themselves. And then somebody else is like, it's theirs, and this is not something that they got permission to use. So, you know, always kind of paying attention to those, things that matter when using somebody else's information. We talk a lot about technology and, you know, trademarking and all these. Well, we've never operated in that system, but even the technology world, well, if you built something, you create it, you put a patent on it, you put your, it's mine. If somebody else were to use it, that person that built that, conceptualized it, they wouldn't like somebody else going off and benefiting from it when they never asked them. So it's kind of the same way in this way of, you know, incorporating ancestral knowledge.
All right. Rafael, any closing comments? First of all, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to do this today. Every time I speak with you, I learn something new and more, and makes me want to help more however I can. So thank you. Any closing comments from you?
So I really was excited about coming on and sharing a little bit about what I know is going on in our communities. And so I think, you know, the opportunity to share information and, you know, if it's new or something you've heard before, you know, part of what I think is important is the more we know about a community of people, and the better we're able to relate, I think the stronger the relationship. And in many of our communities, that relationship matters, and it's front and foremost. So I think that, me being here, looking, even though we're in cyberspace, looking to connect with people in this way, it's an honor for me. And I hope that, as part of what you're looking to accomplish and support in the space of health and wellness for Native people, I hope that there's something that has been helpful to the path you're taking. So I appreciate your time. I know everybody's time is valuable. And so that's kind of, part of what we, when we introduce ourselves, it's, kind of acknowledging that, you know, this time that we're together, it's important. And it's important because we're trying to accomplish something here, and if we can get something from this exchange, it might make a difference. So thank you for this opportunity and for being able to, share some thoughts here.
Excellent. Thank you, Rafael. I believe that's all we have for time, Olivia.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just, before we close out, I want to say thank you to you both, John, for moderating this wonderful discussion, and Rafael, for sharing and imparting on us so much knowledge and so many examples, and also ways that we can really work to infuse technology and innovation within these communities without harming the traditions that are there. And I think from the comments, folks definitely got so much out of this. So again, thank you both. I just wanted to share again that this was recorded, so you will receive access to the recording, a short survey, and the recording will also be available on our website at matter.health/live. So thank you both again, and have a great rest of your day. Take care, everybody.